Chapter 61. Sean returned to Ladyburg in the middle of a misty Natal winter's day. As the train huffed over the rim of the escarpment, he stood on the balcony of his coach and looked out at the vast green stain upon the hills of Lioncop. The sight of it moved him, but his elation was toned with dark colours. "This is the middle of the way. This year I'll be 41 years old. Out of all that striving and folly, something must have emerged. Let me total my assets. In cash I have a little over £2,000, compliments of the War Claims Adjustment Board. In land I have 15,000 acres with an option to purchase as many more. I have 10,000 acres of standing wattle, which in another year will be ready for cutting. My loans against this are heavy, but not oppressive, so I am a wealthy man. In things of the flesh I have a number of grey hairs, a fine collection of scars, and a broken nose. But I can still lift and carry a 200-pound sack of mealies under each arm. I can eat half a young sheep at a sitting. Without field glasses, I can count the number of head in a herd of springbok at a distance of 2 miles. And Candy, who knows about these things, made no complaint about my stamina. I am not yet old. Apart from these things, I have a son who belongs to me, and a son and a daughter who do not. Although I have lost the best of them, I have friends, perhaps more friends than enemies. But as important as any of these is the purpose and direction I have at last achieved. I know what I want. My course is plotted, and the wind stands fair. These are my assets. These are mine to use and enjoy. What are my liabilities? Borrowed money, the hatred of a brother and a son, and Ruth. Ruth is gone. Ruth is gone. Ruth is gone. Clattered the cross ties under the coach. Ruth is gone. Ruth is gone. Ruth is gone. They mocked him. Sean scowled and forcibly changed the words in his mind. The wind is fair. The wind is fair. The wind is fair. Over the months that followed, Sean used his whole energy in the development of Lioncop. He planned the cutting of his standing bark and decided to reap one third of it a year before maturity, and another third in each of the subsequent 2 years. To replace it, he used his £2,000 not to pay off his loans, but to plant the rest of his land to wattle. When this was done, he had to keep busy. He bought himself a theodolite and a book of instruction in elementary survey, and mapped his lands, laid out his block of trees, pegged new roads for access to his plantations when the cutting began. Once again, he had nothing to do. So he went to see Dennis Peterson and spent a long day arguing the purchase of Mahuba's Kloof Ranch, on which he had bought an option. He had no cash, and Jackson's at Natal Wattle balked at the suggestion of further loans. When Dennis refused to consider extended terms of payment, Sean called on Ronnie Pye at the Ladyburg Banking and Trust. It was a forlorn chance, and Sean was genuinely surprised when Ronnie gave him a cup of coffee and a cigar, and then listened politely to his proposition. "You're putting it all on one horse, Sean," Ronnie warned him. "There's only one horse in this race. Can't lose." "Very well," Ronnie nodded. "Here's what I will do with you. I will advance you the full purchase price of Mahuba's Kloof, plus a further £10,000 to develop it. In return, you will give me a first bond on Mahuba's Kloof and a second bond on Lioncop after Natal Wattle Company's loan." Sean took it. A week later, Ronnie Pye called on Jackson in Pietermaritzburg. After the preliminary sparring, Ronnie asked him, "Are you quite happy about those notes you have out to Courtney?" "Well, the security's good," Jackson hesitated. "But he seems to be going a little wild." "I might be willing to take them over from you," Ronnie hinted delicately. And Jackson rubbed his nose thoughtfully to mask his relief. Happily, Sean flung his army of Zulus at the virgin grasslands of Mahuba's Kloof. He delighted in the long ranks of sweating, singing black men, as they opened the rich red earth and placed the fragile little saplings. Dirk was Sean's constant companion in these days. His attendance in the schoolhouse became more sporadic. Convinced that Dirk would never become a scholar, Sean tacitly condoned the gastric disturbances that prevented Dirk leaving for school in the mornings, but cleared miraculously a few minutes later and allowed him to follow Sean out into the plantations. Dirk aped Sean's stance, his seat in the saddle, and his long-reaching walk. He listened carefully to Sean's words and repeated them later without omitting the oaths. In the late afternoons, they hunted quail and pheasant and guinea fowl along the slopes of the escarpment. On Sunday, when Sean rode across to his neighbour's for a bushbuck shoot, or a poker session, or merely to drink brandy and talk, then Dirk went with him. Despite Sean's protest, Ada returned with her girls to the cottage on Proteus Street. So the homestead of Lion Kop was a vast, empty shell. Sean and Dirk used only 3 of the 15 rooms, and even these were sparsely furnished. No carpets on the floor, nor pictures on the walls. A few leather thong chairs, iron bedstead, plain deal tables and a cupboard or two. Piled in odd corners were the books and fishing rods, a pair of shotguns and a rifle on the rack beside the fireplace. The yellow wood floor was unpolished, with dust and bits of fluff beneath the chairs and beds, dark stains left by the litter of pointer puppies. And in Dirk's bedroom, which Sean never visited, there was a welter of old socks and soiled shirts, school exercise books, and trophies of the hunt. Sean had no interest in the house. It was a place to eat and sleep. It had a roof to keep the rain out, a fireplace for warmth, and lamplight so that he could indulge his new appetite for reading. With reading glasses purchased from a travelling salesman on his nose, Sean spent his evenings wading through books on politics and travel, economics and surveying, mathematics and medicine, while Dirk, ostensibly preparing his schoolwork, sat across the fireplace from him and watched him avidly. Some nights, when Sean was engaged in correspondence, he would forget that Dirk was there, and the boy would sit up until after midnight. Sean was now corresponding with both Janni Niemand and Jan Polis Leroux. These two had become a political team in the Transvaal and were already bringing gentle pressure to bear on Sean. They wanted him to organise the equivalent of their South Africa party and to lead it in Natal. Sean hedged. Not yet. Perhaps later, he told them. Once a month, he received and answered a long letter from John Aitchison. Aitchison had returned to England and the gratitude of the nation. He was now Lord Casterbrook, and from his seat in the House of Lords he kept Sean informed of the temper and mood of the English people and the affairs of state. Sometimes, more often than was healthy, Sean thought about Ruth. Then he became angry and sad and desperately lonely. Slowly it would build up within him until he could not sleep. Then he would go down at night to a friendly widow who lived alone in one of the ganger's cottages beside the new railway's yards. Yet he counted himself happy. Until that day at the beginning of September 1903, when he received an embossed card. It said simply, "Miss Storm Friedman requests the pleasure of the company of Colonel Sean Courtney, DSO, DCM, at a party to celebrate her 3rd birthday. 4 p.m., September the 26th. RSVP, The Golds, Chase Valley, Pietermaritzburg." In the bottom right-hand corner was an inky fingerprint about the size of a threepenny piece.